terms of, because actually the
but I told
first book of Tanya, as you know, is called
March 12th, Tanya.
Benonim, the book of the Benoni, because it is designed to explain the nature of the Benoni. So I just want to tell you that it is 53 chapters, and it really breaks up into like four or five subdivisions within those chapters. So just to give you a sense of the overall map, the first eight prakim, Perek Aleph Teches, is what we would call the basic structure of the two souls. That's where the idea of the two souls. Now again, Chazal simply used the term Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, but the Balei Tanya, based on more Kabbalistic terminology, talks about the Nefesh HaBahamas, the animal soul that is even physically situated in the left chamber of the heart, and it resides in the blood, Ki Adam Hu HaNefesh. And then we have the godly soul that originates in the brain, but there actually is a brain and heart connection, because he says that the brain is cognition and thought. In the right part of the soul is what is called the hidden love and the hidden fear for the Almighty, and there is that connection. So basically these two levels of consciousness, the animal soul and the divine soul, are the factors that exist within a human being. And Perek Aleph Teches deals with what you would call the psychological structure of the Jewish soul or the Jewish personality. Now, and again, he's Marich on it. Well, again, we'll look at more details.
Where does that belong? The animal, the divine, the
what?
Psychological.
No, the psychological is the total person. So the total person is composed of these different souls. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this. Someone sent me an article. A professor at GW sent me an article that he did some work about Rav Shalom Ber, who was the Lubavitcher Rebbe before the last Lubavitcher that you had, Rav Menachem Mendel. His father-in-law was Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, and Rav Yosef Yitzchak's father was Rav Shalom Ber, the Rebbe Rashab, as he's called. And Rashab is called among Hasidim, among the Babajers in particular, the Morin of Wichlin of Hasidim. He was a very, very philosophical and very reflective person. And in the history of his life, it talks about the fact that he spent prolonged periods of time in Vienna seeking medical attention. Shabbat says, you know, he was in Vienna for many months. So apparently this doctor unearthed some information that in fact he was seeing Sigmund Freud for issues of depression and other issues, just a very, very amazing type of thing. And he was able to unearth different reminiscences of his discussion. Of course, Sigmund Freud very quickly realized, in a sense, that in terms of understanding the philosophy of the soul, he was dealing with someone who was much greater, and it really turned into kind of a mutual collaboration a little bit. So it was actually very, very fascinating. That the Rebbe and Freud had some extensive discussions on the philosophy of the soul, and the Rebbe's primary text was in fact the Tanya, these two levels of consciousness. Now, from Prakim...
How does this doctor get the medical
Well, he didn't actually get the medical records. What happened basically was that Lubavitch has tremendous archives that are largely secret. In other words, there are inner circle people in Chabad that know all sorts of things about the movement that the average Lubavitcher does not know. And if you make a relationship with somebody, you can find out many, many different things. I mean, the Rebbe Rashab himself wrote memoirs, confidential diaries about this, and it gets regarding the propriety of taking someone's private diary and looking into it, that's always going to be a question, but at least I mean, what he sent me, I did not see anything that was a tremendous breach of confidence other than the fact that he saw Sigmund Freud. And in fact, in many ways, on a personal level, it increased my admiration, because the Rebbe Rashab was a tremendous Rebbe. I mean, he was a prolific writer, a great speaker, an organizer. He established the Lubavitcher Yeshiva, which became very, very successful in the 1920s. He was a very inspiring person. And to know that he was doing this in spite of the fact that, he was prone to sometimes depression and the like, and that did not affect, really, because the Tanya talk, remember, what does the Tanya talk about? The Tanya talks about the idea that sometimes there is this evil in the heart that drags you down, and you don't necessarily have control over your thoughts and your feelings, but you can still make the decision to do the right thing. And this was exactly a living example of that. So if anything, being aware of that, I think, increased my admiration. But be it as it may, in the Prakim of Tess to Yud Zayin, the Balatanya then takes these two structures of the soul and talks about their conflicts. And this is where he develops the definition of the Beinoni, that the Beinoni is not the person who is 50-50, because he brings different proofs that anyone who does a sin is called a Rasha. But a Beinoni is a person who makes the decisions to do the right thing, but he has not vanquished the evil in the left part of his heart, meaning to say he is living in the world of struggle where the evil is there, but he overpowers it. He does not destroy it. The urges are there, but he does not give in to those urges. And this is really the chiddush of the Sefer, that the Beinoni is actually a very perfectly righteous person who lives in the world of struggle, who has not vanquished his evil. And the message of the Baal HaTanya is that this Madrega of Beinoni is achievable by every human being. Every human being, even if we have different negative thoughts, even if we have what we'll call Yetzer Hara, even if we haven't totally destroyed the urges within us, we can always overpower those urges by the koach of the seichel, the koach of the mind, and the connection of the mind, and the hidden love that is in the heart that can be aroused to be connected to Hashem. And again, as I pointed out already, what the Baal HaTanya is actually addressing was the feeling of many of his followers, in which they would always say, I am distraught by thoughts that distract me, by urges to not to keep the mitzvahs, by laziness. And the message basically is that, you know, a person does have this capacity of choice, and the tragic struggle of the Beinoni is that he will never get up in the morning necessarily and feel, I no longer have this struggle, I no longer have this difficulty. This struggle does exist, and this is a person's mission in life. So that's Perek Tes to Yud Zayin deals with that, the definition of the Beinoni. In the Pragna, the third grouping of the chapters, again, this is artificial because the Baal HaTanya does not have section divisions. He just has chapter divisions. But the third section, as it's generally assumed, is Yud Ches to Chaf He. And this goes into the details of how do you utilize the godly soul to not destroy, not to vanquish the animal soul, but to overpower it, to challenge it. In other words, to control it so it does not control you. And here he develops a lot of ideas that are very fundamental in Chabad, and that is the supremacy of the intellect over the emotions, that through the power of the mind we can channel how we feel. We do not have to be controlled by the feelings. Instead of the heart controlling the brain, the mind, which is the repository of the godly soul, can control the emotions and the feelings. Remember, I think I mentioned a vort from the Chassam Sefer, that the meaning of the term melech, a king, could be spelled moach, lev, kalayos. Moach is mind, lev is heart, which is emotions, kalayos are kidneys, which are also like animal passions. And a melech, a king, is one whose moach controls the lev and the kalayos. And the opposite of melech spells the word kalem, kalayos, lev, moach, which means kidneys, heart, mind, in which the mind is simply responding to the animal urges of the body. And the word kalem means destruction, to be destroyed. In fact, I mentioned that the Chassam Sefer actually says, this is the explanation of a Taisus in Maseches Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos says that Bilam, the great sorcerer Bilam, knew the exact fraction of a second in the world where Hashem has tremendous anger. Apparently, there is, the Gemara says in Brachos, Yada Bilam Chavinus Asha, that there is what is called an Idan Ritzcha. There is a time of anger in the world where if you curse somebody during that time of anger, the fury of Hashem is unleashed. And Bilam was able to time his curses to correspond with that time of anger. So Tosfos asks, the Gemara even says, how do you know that time of anger? You know the time of anger because the red comb of the rooster turns white for a millifraction of a second. So the Gemara even says that Rabbi Meir was staring. He wanted to curse his enemies. They were giving him a lot of tsar. So he tied this rooster to his bed, and he was staring at it. Of course, you have to be careful not to blink. But he realized that, basically he blinked, he fell asleep. He realized that he couldn't, and he realized that it was not a Kodesh Baruch Hu's ratzon that you try to time your curses. But Tosfos asks a very simple question. What can you say in that brief hour? You curse in that exact hour. Or not hour, that exact little, it's less than a second. The Gemara gives you a calculation of, in Chalakim. Chalakim are 1,080 of them in an hour. Right? So so the question becomes, what can you say? So Tosfos gives two answers. One answer is that as long as you begin your curse in the Eden Rischa, so you could finish it afterwards, it's effective, everything is toloi, and how you begin. By the way, it's interesting that I think what Fidel Yeshua brings, that some Hasidim, one of the early complaints against the Hasidic movements, not so much the Balatanya, but a complaint that the Gra had against Hasidim, which to some degree is still a complaint in many ways, is that they were not meticulous in observing the times of Kriya Shema and the times of Tefillah. In other words, they were saying Kriya Shema Shelo Bizmana, they were saying Tefillah, Shelo Bizmana, etc. In fact, Rav Chaim Volozhiner even writes in the Nefesh HaChaim that he doesn't mention Hasidim, but he calls them Mavakshei Hashem, and he says, some Mavakshei Hashem say you're not allowed to daven mincha until the sun sets. That's when they want to daven mincha and they see the sun didn't set yet, they say, it's too late, too early rather, we can't daven yet. So this was an old taina against Hasidim. Again, there's certain Hasidim, we still have that problem. So Avodah Yeshua, I think, brings, again, you cannot take this lahalacha, that he says, well, you see, from Klala, that if you begin your curse in the right Zaman, you're allowed to finish it even afterwards. And since HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more generous in good things than in bad things, then Kal V'chaymer, if you begin Kriya Shema and Tefillah in the right Zaman, even if you finish it afterwards, it's going to be good. Again, that's obviously not lahalacha. But so Tysus's first answer is, as long as you begin the klala, you could finish it. The second answer is, he could have said the word kaleim. Kaleim is a single word, kaf lamed mem, and that could be fit under the buzzer. So that I think the Chassam Sefer says that the curse of Bilam is, may you be a person whose emotions control their intellect. Kolayos leiv moach. Right, that's exactly it. So really, that's what the Chassam Sefer says, but that's exactly what the Baal HaTanya is saying, that the supremacy of the intellect over the emotions is how you have the Nefesh Elokis be miskaber. Does not vanquish the Nefesh HaBahamis, but it directs it, it controls it. Both neshamos have a levush, they have a garment. And there are three garments of the soul. And the three garments of the soul are machshava, thought, dibor, speech, and maisa. And those are manifestations of the soul. But they could be taken over by the animal soul. They could be taken over by the godly soul. One has a choice as to where to direct all of these three levushim. So the supremacy of the intellect over the emotions is a fundamental doctrine of the Baal HaTanya. That is why the Hasidic movement that he founded is called Chabad, Chachma Bina Das, because that's exactly it. As opposed to saying my connection to Hashem comes from my emotion, it comes from the intellect that directs those emotions. But he then points out, as I said before, that it's not simply a total one-way street from the mind to the heart, but rather there already is a latent connection in what he calls the right chamber of the heart, which is called the hidden love and the hidden fear of Hashem. And the mind can be like a starter, like a pilot starter, as it were, that can arouse that spark of hidden love to become a manifest, revealed type of love. By the way, he also has an interesting definition in this section that we sometimes look, right, we look at Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. Right, these are the two fundamental pillars of avoda, love of God Then we have fear of God, but again, the word fear itself has many, many components. There is the fear, as it were, of being punished if I do something wrong. That's called yiras ha'onesh. But then there's a concept of fear, which is reverence, awe, respect. That's called yiras haromamos. That is not the fear of punishment, although fear of punishment is a basic thing we have to have, because that keeps us accountable. But this other fear is in the more of the nature of the awesome respect and reverence that one has for the Ribono Shel Olam. So these are two pillars. The Aramaic of it, which is the way the Sifrei Kabbalah use it, the Baal HaTanya use it, it's called Bidechilu Urechimu. The Bidechilu just means with trembling, and Rechimu is with love, but it's Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. But here, the Baal HaTanya has an interesting notion, because he says that love is that feeling within us that urges, that the urge for oneness and connection with God, Devekus. Because that which you love, you want to be connected to. Now, fear, he defines in an interesting way. He says, fear is the dread of being separated from Hashem. It's interesting. In other words, what he defines as yiras ha'onesh, in a higher level, is not fear that God is going to hurt me, but it's fear that because of my averos, I will not have a connection with him. So he says, in that sense, fear and love are not opposites. They're actually the same emotion, in the sense that love is the desire to be connected, and fear is the trepidation of losing that connection by my averos. And therefore he says, the chilu urechimu, both are manifestations of the ava mesuteres, the concealed love that is within the heart of every Jew. Now that's often called in popular terms the pintaliyid, the little spark within the Jewish neshama. People, even if they're very, very far from the Torah, from Hashem, at certain moments in their life, that love will express itself. You know, we have stories in the Holocaust, for example, of, you know, people who were not shomer mitzvahs, but in their last minutes, you know, the stories about the Nazis were commanded some fellow I remember reading who was not religious, and he was actually anti-religious, and the Nazis commanded him to step on a Sefer Torah. And, the last minute of his life, he took the Torah. He was going to throw it down. Yeah, it meant nothing to him. But as soon as the Torah was in his hands, he started dancing with the Torah, like the Hakafas of Simchas Torah, and he literally got into a frenzy that somehow it made some connection to him. It was an example of this hidden love just coming out, and he got killed, and etc. But in the last moment of his life, that's what he did. So therefore, the Baal HaTanya says that it's not simply this cold mental state in which your feelings are in one place and your mind is in the other place, but rather ultimately the mind is a mechanism that can arouse the hidden love and the hidden fear in the right side of the heart, which in turn could be misgaber over the left side of the heart, which is the repository of the animal soul. All right, so that's 18-25, in which he talks about the practical ways, in some way, that you can actualize the feelings of the heart through contemplation and thought. And again, this is continued in 26-31, where he talks about the fact that we do have control. Again, this is a point. We do have control. This is his whole idea. And he talks particularly about how simcha is necessary. But he says, simcha and atzvus, well, I'll say, simcha and sadness, are not inconsistent. He has different typologies of different types of joys and different types of sadnesses. He says that the word atzev, sadness, is kind of a passive type of sadness. It is the sadness of despondency. It is the sadness of worthlessness. It is the sadness of passivity. That, he says, is very destructive. That is simply an animal soul that's weighing you down. That doesn't take you anywhere. And that type of sadness one needs to banish from their life, because that is a sadness that is simply a weight or an albatross or a boulder that is preventing the godly soul from overpowering the Nefesh HaBehemis. But then he says there's a different type of sadness, which is the sadness of yearning to be close to Hashem when you know that you're so far from it. And therefore, it creates a resolve or a resolution to move forward. Now, that type of sadness, he says, has a place. Because if a person doesn't have the sadness of realizing they haven't achieved their goals, then that generates complacency as well. So if a person feels, I'm exactly happy where I am. In other words, I have nothing, you know, no regrets. I'm exactly where I should be. That has a drawback. So what he talks about in these chapters, 26 to 31, is he basically deals with what you might call good sadness and what you might call bad sadness, recognizing that certain sadness is paralyzing and passive, and certain sadness can be energizing. But he makes the point, and again, he's speaking to his chassidim, that they should set aside times. It's interesting, you know, this is under the Tanya, and it's foreign to us in many, many ways, because he seems to assume, for a Devar Pashat, that it's relatively easy to control your emotions. You turn them on and off. He says, you should dedicate certain times every day to be sad about your distance from Hashem. But confine it. Shut it off afterwards. And then be besimcha. But you need to have that sense of, you know, I am far from Hashem, as it were. But he does warn you that if you stay in it too long, it's going to take you into a bad place. By the way, just Derech Agav, I was thinking of a thought. I think the Sfas Emes says the basis of this thought. You know, this Shabbos we read about the Parah Aduma, the red heifer. And the red heifer is a mystery. It's a chok. It's one of those, it is the mitzvah for which we're told even Shlomo HaMelech was not able to fully understand. And one of the reasons why it's a chok, the main reason why it's a paradox, is the phenomenon of mitamei es hatahirim u'mitayir es hatmeim. Right? The Parah Aduma says, if I'm tamei, if I came in contact with a dead body, so if I'm sprinkled with the waters and ashes of the Parah Aduma, I become tohar. Right? If I'm sprinkled on the third day and on the seventh day of my tuma, so upon sunset of the seventh day, I am now tohar. That's why all of us are tamei today, because even if we go to the mikvah, if any of us have ever been in a cemetery, we are tamei for life until we have the sprinkling of the Parah Aduma. That's why every person is tamei. However, the Torah also says that all the people that handle the Parah Aduma become tamei in the process of handling it. Now, they're not tamei for 7 days, and they don't need to be sprinkled with Parah, otherwise you'd have an infinite problem that nobody could ever... But they're tamei for a day, they have to go to the mikvah, then they're tohar. They don't need to be sprinkled, per se. But the paradox that Shlomo HaMelech couldn't understand is, how can the same koach that brings purity into the world be a koach that generates impurity? So I believe the Sfas Emes says, and I think it's a thought that is very, very consistent with this part of the Tanya, and that is, ashes represents humility. It represents self-abnegation. It represents, as it were, the obliteration of ego. You take something and you reduce it to ashes. Avraham Avinu says to Hashem, Anechi afar ve'efer, I am dirt and ashes. It's kind of the ultimate statement of insignificance. And ashes is a great, great vehicle for purity. Because when a person has gaiva, when a person has arrogance, when a person has complacency, he is pushing Hashem out of his heart. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually says that for the arrogant person, there's not enough room in the world for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Baal Gaiva. So it is understandable why my contact with ashes can give me purity and liberation from death, because ashes symbolize humility and self-effacement. But maybe the lesson is the same thing that can bring purity, if taken in the wrong direction, can create impurity. Because the feeling of ashes, which represents the idea that I'm nothing, that I'm worthless, can be a very powerful energizer to stimulate a person towards serving Hashem. But But if you take a wrong turn with it, it could lead to depression, it could lead to despair, it could lead to a sense of the opposite, because a person might say, hey, if I'm nothing, then why should HaKadosh Baruch Hu care about what I do? Right? So the Sfas Emes says, that's why the same koach that can create purity can chas v'shalom be the biggest yetzer hara. In fact, it says the biggest yetzer hara that people have is the yetzer hara of yiyush. Yiyush is giving up hope. I'm nothing. I can't accomplish anything. Now, that's often an excuse, right? So that's why the Baal HaTanya says, this is like a very powerful medicine that's poisonous if you take too much of it. That is, you need the sadness of knowing our worthlessness, in a sense, as an energizing principle to come closer to God. But don't dwell on it too much. You dwell on it too much, it'll take you in the wrong direction. It'll destroy your confidence and your ability to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a great love, a love for you. That's what the Sfas Emes says by the Parah Aduma. And this actually is another statement. Now, many people think this is a statement in Chazal. It actually is not a statement in Chazal. It's a statement from the predecessor of Ger, Rav Simcha Bunim Rav Peshitzchus, who was Hasidish Rebbe in the 19th century. People often quote this as a medrash, but it's not. That a person has to have two ideas in his two pockets at all times. One is, Anochi Afor V'Yefer, I am dirt and ashes. And the other is, Bishvili Nivra Olam. Bishvili Nivra Olam means, because of me. Now that's taken from the Mishnah. Right? The Mishnah says that if Hashem made many animals, why did he only create one human being or two human beings? So one answer is that each human being should look at the universe and say, this whole universe was worthwhile just for me. Hashem made the whole universe for one person. Now, these are opposites. I am nothing. Because of me, the universe was created. But that's exactly the polarity. A person has to know that they're nothing. They depend on the grace of Hashem. But at the same time, Hashem's love for us is so infinite that he created a whole universe so we would be able to flourish. That's what the Sfas Emes says is the meaning of the Parah Aduma enigma. And that's what the Baal HaTanya is discussing in this concept of the need for sadness to be combined with simcha, because sadness, despondency, and the like. Actually, Rebbe Akiva Eiger has another interesting mashal about sadness. It moves in a slightly different direction. You know, David HaMelech says in Tehillim Kuf Yud Tes, Sas Aneichi Alim Rasacha Kemaitzei Shalal Rav. That means what? I rejoice, David HaMelech says, I rejoice over your words of Torah as if I found a great treasure. Great treasure. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, living in Olam Hazeh is like, imagine if you were put on an island, and the island was filled with jewels and diamonds and rubies, as far as you can see. And the person who dropped you off, the melech, dropped you off on the island and says, you have 24 hours, whatever you take is yours. Whatever you don't take is not never going to be yours. So on one hand, every single second there's this tremendous joy, another diamond, another ruby, etc. But there's also a sadness, because you know no matter how much you take, there's going to be so much that you left behind that you couldn't get to. David HaMelech says, that's what the Torah is. I rejoice over your Torah like I found a great treasure, meaning everything I take is this amazing wealth, but it's only a little fraction of what I could take. And that's why they say the Gra, at the Vilna Gaon's deathbed, he was crying because he says, in Olam Hazeh, for a few pennies, you could do the mitzvah of tzitzis, for example. In Olam Haba, you can't do any of these mitzvahs. Okay, so this notion of sadness and joy is, again, it's a major, major dichotomy. And the Baal HaTanya once again is saying, through the mind, we can kind of channel the moments to be sad and reflective, and the moments to be joyous. But you see this. You see this, by the way, in the writings of all the Hasidic masters, that the concern for depression was a major, major concern. You know, even in yeshivas, and you have the same issue. Because, you know, I know that there are, you know, we have a whole genre of Musar books, which are sometimes very tough on people. And I am aware of sometimes Rosh Yeshivas tell their students not to learn certain types of Sifrei Musar, because it will tend to make the students depressed. And if they lose their self-confidence, they will not be able to serve Hashem properly. They'll actually say, this sefer is not for you. That doesn't mean it's not a true sefer. Obviously, it's true, but, you know, certain personalities are less able to take certain types of teachings. That's why, generally speaking, I mean, you know, just like you have in the secular schools, you know, a greater emphasis on self-esteem than in the olden days, right? In the olden days, you know, they would, you know, if somebody didn't do well, they would get criticized. Today, we tend to sugarcoat things in ways. So in spiritual life, it's that way, too. It's when you have weaker generations. So we tend to say, you know, we're really wonderful, we have mistakes, etc. But the Bala Tanya was very sensitive to the notion that sadness can be something that's very, very negative unless it's in appropriate proportions to the simcha that needs to exist. So that's the 26 to 31, the combination of sadness and joy. Now, Perek Lamed Beis, I see an observation from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, which, interestingly enough, Perek Lamed Beis, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, stands alone. That chapter 31 is actually connected to chapter 33. Chapter 32 is an independent digression that is not connected to anything. And significantly, the theme of chapter 32 is Avas Yisrael, loving your fellow Jew. And the Rebbe pointed out that the Gematria, or the Lama chapter 32, is Lev, heart. And the Bala Tanya in the chapter on the heart wanted to emphasize Avas Yisrael. And the interesting thought of the Bala Tanya, there are a lot of interesting, just incisive observations in the middle of these long analyses. He points out that Avas Yisrael is easily achieved when you focus on the soul more than the body. Because when you focus on bodies, each of us are different. In physicality, there is distinctions among human beings. Right? My body is a separate entity. And when there are distinctions, then each person looks out for themselves. I'm me, you're you, and therefore there will be division, divisiveness, polarization. But when you focus on the soul, which comes from God, ultimately all souls are united because they come from the same oneness. And therefore, in a sense, on that level, there is no longer a me and a you, because on the level of godly soul, we are ultimately all united from a single source. So he points out, the Bala Tanya says, that as one focuses on strengthening the godly soul, that will inevitably spill over into love of your fellow Jew, because in a sense, all of us are in fact one. In fact, that's an interesting point, that Avas Yisrael is in fact an expression of self-love. The person loves himself. But if I and you, our souls are rooted in that same origin, then just as, you know, if I love my right hand, I love my left hand, right? I don't differentiate between different parts of me, it's all me. So my love can spill out to everybody, at least all Jews. Again, the Bala Tanya is not a universalist, we have to say. He does not talk about the godly soul of non-Jews. But at least with respect to Jews, he does say that Avas Yisrael will come by strengthening the Nefesh Elokitz, because that itself fosters unity. Actually, that goes back to an interesting point Rav Shimon Shkup actually makes. He says that the meaning of the verse, the famous verse, V'yahavta l'reyecha kamocha, love your neighbor, love your friend as you love yourself, could be translated slightly differently. Love your neighbor for he is as yourself, meaning to say, we are actually the same. And all love is self-love, but as a person gets greater, he expands the concept of the self. You love yourself, but who is myself? Myself could be my spouse, my children, my community, my nation, etc. One progressively expands their notion of self to create a greater enhanced selfhood. And that's what the Bala Tanya says in Perek Lamed Beis, that this is the chapter of Avas Yisrael that is based on strengthening the godly soul. Now we're towards the third of the book, in chapters 33 and 37, that's Lamed Gimel to Lamed Zayin. He now deals with more long-term goals, that is, If my mission in life, the Benoni's mission, is to engage in struggle, knowing ahead of time that I'm never going to destroy that evil, but I will simply subdue it, but it's always going to be there, what is the ultimate purpose? And then he talks about the coming of Mashiach, the Techiyas HaMesim, and he says that the ultimate goal, which will not be realized in this world, will be that the evil itself will be converted into good, but that is already messianic, and that will be a direct result of man's conscious efforts in the world of struggle to eventually have victory. Again, this is somewhat reminiscent. I don't think the Baal Tanya says it here, but I think he says it elsewhere. This is really Yaakov's struggle with the angel. Remember, you have this very mysterious scene in the Torah when Yaakov comes back to Eretz Yisrael. So he struggles with the angel. Well, it says Ish, but Chazal understand this as the guardian angel of Esav. And they're wrestling all night. And then the morning comes, and Yaakov is limping. But Yaakov is victorious even though he's limping. And the angel gives Yaakov a new name, Yisrael. You have struggled and excelled with God. And I think the explanation that's given is that the struggle is a metaphor, really, for the struggle not just against the nations of the world, but the struggle that we have with the evil within ourselves. That this is a struggle that will go on for the entire night. Olam Hazeh is night. And it is only in the morning that a final victory is going to be achieved. And that's a remez to the days of Mashiach and Techiyas HaMesim. And this is exemplary of the internal spiritual struggle. In fact, that's the meaning of the Gemara. The Gemara in Chulin has a discussion. Who did this angel look like? So according to one opinion, he looked like a bandit, an axe murderer. According to the other opinion, he looked like a Talmud Chacham with a long white beard. So how could that be? So part of how some learned this whole dream-like sequence was that Yaakov is looking into himself. And Yaakov, as the prototypical righteous person, sees in himself the saint, the pious person, the righteous person, and sees in himself the struggle with his baser impulses. And therefore, both of those images are very, very true. And it's only in the morning, Techiyas HaMesim, coming of Mashiach, in which you have that ultimate tikkun. But the Baal HaTanya says that the tikkun of Yemot HaMashiach is a function of the struggle that we go through in this world. And therefore, we are effectively creating the Messianic era by what we do. So now we come to the very last part of the Tanya, in which he then wants to talk about the fact that in spite of the fact that we live in this world of struggle, and we're told ahead of time, we're not going to vanquish this evil until the coming of Mashiach. We will just be able to control it and subdue it. He does want to say that Hashem gives us mechanisms by which we can taste the world to come, even in this world. There is a foreshadowing. There is a taste. And here again, he talks about the notion of, he describes it this way. He says, the whole process of creation was God was materializing the spiritual. This is an interesting idea. Because, you know, the typical way Chazal described creation, and the Rambam, really all the Rishonim describe creation, is Yesh Me'ayim. Yesh Me'ayim is creation ex nihilo. That means creation out of nothing. There was the absolute nothingness, and God created something from nothing. Yesh Me'ayim. This, by the way, was opposed by Aristotle. Aristotle argued that it was logically impossible for something to be generated out of nothingness, and there must have been what was called primeval matter. So although Aristotle believed in a prime mover, he did not believe that matter could be generated out of nothingness. Interestingly enough, the Rambam's own position philosophically is a little complicated. The Rambam actually says in the Mora Nevuchim that a belief in primeval matter would not necessarily be inconsistent with a belief in a God, but he just says, as a matter of tradition, Jews don't believe in it. But he doesn't consider it to be a heretical belief in and of itself. Okay, but putting that aside, though, we typically describe creation as something coming out of nothing. But the Arizal, the Mekubalim, say it's exactly the opposite. Creation is not something from nothing. It's really nothing from something. Because before there was a creation, all there was God. God is the ultimate reality. Because matter disintegrates. Matter is not real, in the sense, because matter does not go on forever and ever. So what you had before creation was yesh, the real yesh. Yesh is, you know, the real substance. Now, how did creation take place? So the Arizal says, and this is where the Baal HaTanya develops this, we have what is called the doctrine of Tzimtzum. Now, Tzimtzum literally means withdrawal or contraction. And it starts off as a very simple question, almost like a child's question. If God is everywhere, then how could there be room for me? How can I occupy the place where God is? So the Arizal answers, again, almost a childlike answer, that God contracted within himself to make room for me. Now, what that means is obviously, you know, beyond us, but essentially what it's suggesting is that in order for matter to exist, God had to make room for it. And in a sense, create the illusion. Now, it's not a real Tzimtzum, because Hashem is everywhere, but it's the illusion of withdrawal and concealment. Now, this is a much more powerful thought than you might imagine, because it's not just referring to the, you know, crude idea that God makes physical room. It also explains why there's evil in the world, because God creates a world in which it seems as if he's absent. This is how free choice can exist in the world. Because if I would be totally aware of Hashem's presence, how could I ever sin? It would be impossible. Right? Even a serial rapist is not going to rape in front of a policeman with a gun. In fact, that's often the test in some criminal. There's a famous forensic psychiatrist, I think Park Dietz is his name, he's a professor at Hopkins. And like his test, he always testifies for prosecutions. Prosecutions love him for this, because he doesn't believe anybody's insane. Because his test basically is, would you commit the crime if there was a policeman watching you with a gun? And if you wouldn't, you have enough self-control not to be classified as criminally insane. So basically, with that type of testimony, nobody ever really has an insanity defense. But the concept is the same thing. If I would be aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could I ever sin? How could there be free will? And if the world needs free will, you have to have a world where Hashem is concealed. So Tzimtzum is not just the origin of my physical ability to be here. It is the origin of autonomy. It is the origin of free will. It is also the origin of evil. Because if you lived in a world where good people always got rewarded, then my choice of good would not be a matter of choice, it would be a matter of convenience. You know, the pigeon in a Skinner box that always chooses the lever that gives it corn is not making a morally virtuous choice. It is making a choice based on convenience and expediency. So if you think about it, if Hashem wants human beings, or wants Jews in particular, to choose goodness because it is virtuous, you have to build into the system the notion that in the short run, you don't always get advantage from it. Because otherwise, our choices would not be virtuous. Our choices would be as mechanical as the pigeon that chooses the corn over the electric shock. You see? So in these prakim, the Baal HaTanya develops the notion of Tzimtzum as a facilitator of free will. Tzimtzum as a facilitator of godliness, because once again, the characteristic of God is a free agent. God does not act by compulsion. So when we exercise free choice, we are exercising our godly capacities. because that's what Hashem is. Hashem is a chooser. And therefore he says, if creation actually means progressive concealment of the divine light in more and more physical veils, that's what creation is, then that's what God does. What we do is we spiritualize the physical by stripping away the veils in a reverse creation. In other words, God's job was to conceal himself in successive layers of physicality. Our job is to strip away those layers. So it's kind of, you know, you could say, well, we're working at cross purposes, right? No, that's the idea. God conceals, and our job is to reveal. And this is where the Baal HaTanya writes that his famous interpretation, that the word olam, comes from the word he'elam. He'elam is concealment. The nature of olam is concealment. Although I've always had a kasha on that, because we use the word olam not just for olam hazeh, we also use it for olam haba. I think in olam haba, the concept of concealment is a little less clear, that would be a world more of revelation, although I suppose that even then the ultimate mitzvah of Hashem is concealed. But at least Olam Hazeh is the world of Helam. And therefore he says, in this way, if you perceive the ability to spiritualize the physical, you experience an Olam Haba-like existence, even in Olam Hazeh. And you get a taste of the Messianic era. Of course, Chazal already say that Shabbos itself is a taste of Olam Haba and a taste of Yemos HaMashiach. Right, so this is kind of a little bit of an outline of this Sefer Shel Beinonim. As I say, it's not an easy Sefer to look at line by line by line, because much of the allusions require a greater knowledge of Kabbalah than I have, than most of us. Most of us have, and the like. And I also have to say that the style is sometimes it's a more complicated style than we're used to. I know that Norman Lamb, the former president of YU, wrote a book on Rav Chaim of Elazhin, the Nefesh HaChaim, and he tries to contrast the Nefesh HaChaim and the Baal HaTanya, because the two Svarim. Rav Chaim of Elazhin was a student of the Vilna Gaon, obviously, and the Vilna Gaon had disagreements with the Baal HaTanya, with Hasidus in general, but specifically the Baal HaTanya. And Norman Lamb tries to contrast the style, and he points out that although from a literary perspective he feels the Tanya is a much more superior literary work than the Nefesh HaChaim, but he says it's also a much more complicated and complex way of speaking. So Rav Chaim of Elazhin, he says, was more straightforward. Now, those things are probably intimately connected. Usually the greater works of literature, Lahavdil, tend to be more complex in the development of their ideas. But I think it is always useful to at least have a map before you get into the line-by-line types of things. We're not going to do line-by-line anyway, but we'll do some selected parakim. But this is what the Sefer Shel Beinonim is ultimately about. The world of struggle, the ability to control our emotions, the simultaneous need for sadness, introspection, reflection, combined with joy in the service of God, the importance of Avas Yisrael, of recognizing that all of our souls are ultimately united, and the fact that what we do in this world is an investment in creating the perfection of the Messianic era, and the fact that in this world we are given moments where we can experience that type of perfection by removing the veils that conceal God's presence in this world. And here the Baal HaTanya quotes a medrash, but he quotes a famous medrash that Ratzah Kadosh Baruch Hu, it was Hashem's desire, Sheyielo Dira Betachtonim, that he would have a dwelling place in this low world, this lowly world. In fact, if you look at the Yamim Naran prayers, so one of the piyutim, actually it comes in two different versions, it's two piyutim, in which we alternate stanzas in which we talk about Hashem being praised among the angels. That the angels are this and that and that and that, but for Ratzisa Shevach, but you, Hashem, want praise. And then it talks about the lowliness of the human being, But this is what Hashem wants. Hashem wants the praise from those who are much, much removed from the spirituality of the angels. And that's, that was Hashem's ratzon, that his dira would be betachteinu. And in fact, you know, even Christianity, l'havdil, I mean, ultimately stems from that, although it's a perversion. In other words, they took the idea of God desiring a dwelling place among men, and they perverted it into the literal, that God became human to kind of become one of us. Now, that is an outgrowth of the Jewish philosophy of God wanting to dwell among men. It is a perversion of it, of course, because we don't believe that God is, it can be a human form in any sense. But theologically, it is an extension of this idea of God wanting to share the travails of human beings. And as David HaMelech says, Imo Anochi B'tzara, Hashem suffers with the sufferings that we go through. Okay, so let's stop here. Good Shabbos.
I should take note when I read the Rav Kook.
Yes.
A lot of there's always a feeling of you shouldn't make yourself that you don't have these desires to do, because then that is worse than a hate.
You don't deny yourself.
No, all kind of things.
I know Rav Kook in fact, one of the svarim that Rav Kook had on his desk at all times, it wasn't the Tanya, but it was the Tipei Torah, which is the Alter Rebbe's Sefer HaKumish, where he elaborates on all these things.
Now that I read lately that Rav Kook, I find a lot of
things. No question. He's very close to Chabad. In fact, in Lithuania, his city, he was a rav of Bybrisk, which was a Chabad city. He was very, very well-versed in Chabad philosophy. In fact, it's only in America, really, that Chabad stuff is only Lubavitch learns. I mean, in Europe, this was widely learned by many people. Now it's become kind of a monopoly a little bit. Okay.
I have for you something in the
but I think there are reasons for this. Rav Ritterman Zatzal, actually his father was a Lubavitcher. His father was a Lubavitcher, and when he went to Slobodka, I think the elder Slobodka told him that he shouldn't follow it, so he actually had a... I'm not sure if there was some incident, but I think he was actually somewhat against Chabad. Weinberg also has that. Weinberg also has that. Weinberg comes from a Hasidic family. He was a Slonimer. And whatever. But I think this was not so much against the Tanya. It wasn't against that. It was against things that happened later. Right. Slonimer Hasidim. In fact, I understand that Rav Weinberg was in line for succession at some point to be Rebbe.
Oh.
Yeah, in fact, the Rebbe's are Barzovsky and Weinberg, the two families. So Weinberg is the main family name to the second Rebbe.
That's the same family?
Yeah. If you look, now at Brisk in particular, they publish now Maisa books about Brisk, the Brisk Rebbe, stories, Hasidic stories about the Brisk Rebbe. Every little thing he did, what he ate, and they really have turned it into a Mikvah Hasidus.
They make
from a big well, he said the Muslim movement, the Hasidic movement, more or less started it at about the same time.
Right.
And one has spread out throughout the whole world,
right.
And the Muslim movement practically doesn't exist anymore, although we read there
right.
are things, but it's not a movement anymore.
Right.
So he said he thinks the reason is everybody worships Rabbi Yisrael Salantarim. So it's like Torah. The further away you go from the Shul
Salantarim, it's gotten
Adoros. But the Siddim taught that the next Rebbe is Miskadosh Bimeimo. And so the next Rebbe is as big in the eyes of the community as his father or his grandfather or his great-grandfather. They don't have this.
And he has the cumulative of the Chasavos.
Not just
right.
a Tzadik Ben Tzadik.
Tzadik Ben Tzadik Ben Tzadik.
They don't do this half-life thing like
And the Hasidic Sfarim, they talk about the different.
That's the key to this pashtus, is to teach people that there's a vibrancy, and it can grow, not diminish.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
His father was Reverend Pesek?
Yes. But when he was Reverend Pesek, there was only one Rav. Pesek became a immigrant to flights for New Yorkers for less expensive housing. Pesek was in the old days. It's just its own community. It's now a suburb of New York. He was a Chevroner. He learned the same thing. He was a very smart man, but he was liberal and native to Mizrahi. So,
in those years, before World War II, many American chashev and rabbanim were Mizrahi, wasn't?
In America, not in Poland. So.
In America, but even in Poland. I mean, the Rav of Mea Sharim. In the 1930s, and in fact, there are yeshivas in Mea Sharim named after him, which are Hasidic yeshivas. Was Rav Yosef Gershon Hurwitz was a member of Mizrahi. Mea Sharim was Mizrahi.
Three pace of front before he became appointed by the Rabbanut, as Rav Rashi of Yerushalayim was considered a place of God there all over. But then, when he took a government position, so people.
And Rav Yosef had. I mean, if people don't remember, Rav Yosef was a dayan in the Rabbanut space. It's like he's still a little. I mean, there are Hanan in July, and they're not acceptance because of that. No, guilt by association. That's right.
First of all, you take from the government. Why doesn't it start? I was thinking about adjusting it to today without really for you to prepare a new lecture. I mean, this material, what do you think?
Yeah. It's possible. Let me ask you another question. Obama just announced a change in stem cell research.
Yeah.
It's people are interested. I know that. I know people are very interested. Maybe why don't you ask about that? That would be the easiest thing for me.
This is not so easy.
It's not so easy. I have to get psychologically into it.
Because this is.